Hello, and welcome to Season 4, Episode 1 of the Green Data Center Podcast. We took a break to go ahead and revamp a few things, including the website at greendatacenterman.com. But in that time, there has been a lot of things happening, a lot of things brewing, so we'll try to touch on some of those major things. Some are even just as new as yesterday, and others are things that we've been tracking since even the podcast started, so we'll try to touch on all those major issues. The team here reminded me to remind you to like and subscribe to Green Data Center Podcast, so that way you know what's coming out and when. Plus, it's a great way to understand how we're doing, that feedback, and what's going on. So we're really looking forward to that. And of course, if you have notes, anything that you'd like to talk about, feel free to hit the website greendatacenterman.com and send us a note. We'll keep going with the things that we think are important, but if you think something's important, it would be good to know and touch on that too. Let's start with safety. And those that are around data centers, building, constructing, designing, talk about safety all the time because it is paramount. And it might be a little annoying to hear it here as well, but it is paramount. And that's what brings us to an electrical incident that happened at Google's Iowa data center. Now, an electrical incident is typically an arc flash. You have something that happens and something hasn't de-energized or whatever the case might be, you do have equipment wear, and that's why electrical equipment is also needed to be maintained, reviewed, checked in on, make sure that that equipment is operating and functioning correctly so that you don't have an outage, number one, but number two, that you're not going to have an electrical incident that can hurt people. This particular incident at Google's Iowa data center, which has been there for a number of years, and if you haven't been there, it's really quite a massive thing like a lot of their data centers, but it's operating super efficiently. The facility has been there for over a decade, so whenever you have a data center about that old, you need to really make sure that you have that maintenance routine down. You can sort of sit back and say, you know what, we've been operating for the last 5 years, nothing has happened, whatever that is, you know, even 10 years, whatever that case may be, but the next day something might happen. So electrical equipment, just like mechanical and other equipment, you need to take care of it. You need to maintain it. So not sure what the root cause of this was, but three people were injured, all electricians that were working on the local substation that serves the data center. So that means that the data center itself wasn't anywhere near the problem. It was not somebody walking down the halls of the data center and touched the wrong server. Not at all. This is where the larger power exists, that even before you get onto the data center campus, that the substation is there, and it might be controlled by the electrical company or by Google, and the electricians might have been injured. So it was more of a tangential, but of course, this hit our news because it was next to the data center, even though it wasn't in the data center proper. And that's just another reminder to be safe out there. Things do happen. You try to have as much control as you possibly can, but you know, there's a lot of things that will just happen due to the wear and tear of equipment. So hopefully we're maintaining all that equipment and doing so safely. All right, another thing that happened with Google, it's a 1-2 punch this week with Google. They lost their search engine for about 10 minutes. I know, a whole 10 minutes. But it's really reliable. So the Google services, including their search engine, has been really reliable for years and years and years. It's one of the main services they provide, of course. And whenever you have something dip down for even 10 minutes, people are going to notice. There's all sorts of agencies that track these things. And when they notice this, they notice when it popped back up. And of course, Google was quick to address this and said, oh, okay, look, there was a software update issue. It occurred. And guess what? We briefly lost that availability for that search and the maps for just a moment, basically a blip. Now, that's not a major blip, but of course it hits the news, you know, because Google is, you know, very reliable services, and people are going to go ahead and report on that anyway. But of course, there's all sorts of issues that hit all of the data centers and all the services. We've talked about Facebook, we've talked about Meta, you know, some of the things that they've had being knocked offline. And Google, of course, is not alone, so there's others that also have outages, but they're usually very short interruptions if they happen at all. But one of the reasons why this hit the news was because it was a global outage. So that's what even makes it that much greater. So it's not something where there was service in a certain zone or a certain area that was affected because of, say, a certain telecom or something like that. This had everything to do with Google doing their own internal process updates, and it knocked things down just for that 10 minutes, worldwide. So that's why it kind of made the news. And, well, since we're picking on Google a lot, let's talk about what happened last week, speaking of outages. Yes, Google's London data center had an outage, and they looked at it as simultaneous failure of multiple cooling systems. And there's redundancy built into those cooling systems, and they're still looking at what might have caused that as their root cause. But even though Google's that big name, they were not the only ones taken offline during that heat wave. And again, that was 40 degrees Celsius, 104 degrees Fahrenheit. So yeah, pretty warm as far as a heat wave goes. Now, for those of you that are, say, closer to the equator or, you know, in other countries that are used to the heat being really high during the summer months, you might say, well, what's the big deal? The big deal is these data centers were not designed for this. Okay, they were designed to run at a little bit cooler, and whenever they hit these max temperatures, the capacity that they might have might be too great for what they're looking to deal with. So whenever you have something with a cooling system, one might fail, but the thing is, you have redundant cooling systems for just that reason. But in this case, it might have been cascading failures, where if you have several units fail or can't keep up, and they might trip out due to an overwhelming electrical surge or whatever that might be. But it can take off those services or take them offline. And whenever that happens, you have that customer outage. So you notice that, you know, if you're from the customer side, you have an unavailability to the things that you're looking to access. Your products are impacted. And of course, that's not good. Nobody likes that. So what happened, right? You have to look at what went on. Well, one of the things that they do, and most data centers do, is they realize they could not keep the data center cool with its operations. So instead of risking damage to the machines or to other equipment, they decided to bring the entire data center down and then go ahead and restart later once they were able to figure out the causes and come to a solution. That prevents longer outages, prevents damage, prevents anything like damage to the equipment, any damage to the equipment at the facility level, the IT equipment, etc. So across the board, they realized, you know what, we are running at a certain temperature here that's not sustainable. We need to go ahead and bring the whole service down. So that's what they did. Now, of course, looking at this in hindsight, you might say, well, why don't you just bring down part of it, or, you know, certain rooms maybe that are, you know, not being cooled well enough. Well, that's what we don't see quite yet, is what that reliability, that redundancy that's built into that cooling system, how those multiple failures led to the whole facility being taken down in a safe manner. And maybe there was a way that they originally planned on staging this, but whenever you start looking at that during the middle of a heat wave, it just doesn't make much sense, and things can spiral out of control on temperature very quickly. So if you've ever noticed and had an outage in a data center, but you kept your machines running but not your cooling systems running, you can get a lot of heat build up very quickly. And we're talking in seconds is the measurement, not minutes, not hours. We're talking in seconds that the temperature can spiral out of control. So 30 seconds goes by, you're starting to get to your upper extremes. 60 seconds, 90 seconds, you have your IT equipment starting to go ahead and limit its operations, its performance. And then, of course, as the temperature keeps spiraling upward in a room where there's no cooling, you can get those servers just shut down. Now, the follow-up to this so far is that Google is looking into, of course, the root cause for the cooling issues, but also to see what they can do to mitigate against the next heat wave that might come out. On top of this, there were regional services that were impacted. So there were customers that were impacted across multiple zones because they couldn't do like the regional trafficking, and there's routing changes. There's replication changes for data from one zone to another zone. All of that was affected. So all of these things and all these tools that happen behind the scenes in order to allow people to have access smoothly and seamlessly across any different network or wherever they might be, all of that was interrupted during this process. So, of course, you have a lot of people that are looking into this and saying, well, how can we go ahead and have that customer data available, those tools available across those multiple zones, even, say, with this one data center outage, in order to make sure that it doesn't affect anyone else and doesn't cause like a regional outage that might affect other people or other businesses like this one did. And the thing is, it was pretty small by comparison as far as who's that really affected. But even something so small like that means that it could happen to others. Of course it could. It could happen to all of the data centers out there. And the way that Google handled it was probably the best way that they knew how, and probably the best thing that they could have done at the time. Now what they're looking at is, well, maybe there's a way that we can have some failover scenarios or some automation behind that and say, let's go ahead and repair this and prepare for the next time that this might happen so that you can have those different things and retest that so that it will not knock down that entire network or that availability, even though you might have to bring the entire data center down. So while the mechanical and electrical designers and engineers might be looking at the facility side, you have everyone that's running the tools and the operations and the IT looking at it from that side. And maybe there's some tools that can have some automatic protections to make sure that if something does happen, like a massive heat wave, they can go ahead and be prepared and then have that customer data and everything else, all the tools that they need, still operational during that time. Now, it might seem like I'm picking on Google a lot, but really they've just been in the news for some of these things. But they weren't the only ones affected by this heat wave, right? Oracle was also affected. And then there is another one called Guy's and St. Thomas NAHS Foundation Trust that was also affected by an outage. There's a lot that can be done to mitigate it against a heat wave like this, but whenever you do have some of those cooling systems start to fail, and then you just have a cascading failures, or just that redundancy or reliability isn't what you thought it was, well, that's going to be a problem. And you might say, well, that's a one and done with a heat wave like this. No, we're going to have multiple heat waves coming up, so we better learn how to deal with them. And if we think that this is the last one in London, even this year, we should probably prepare for more than that. The higher temperatures is something that we should expect as well. So 104 degrees Fahrenheit, 40 degrees Celsius. Yes, that's pretty high. That was causing a lot of issues across London. But we probably should be prepared for even surging temperatures that are higher than that. So we start to look at what the data centers are prepared for, what they were originally designed for, those cooling systems, and how they're operating. And we need to back into what that needs to be. What's going to happen when our outside air temperature is so high? What happens when it gets to 105, 110 degrees Fahrenheit out there? That's going to be even more problematic, and it might lead to a squeeze on that temperature on any air-cooled devices or even the water-cooled ones that are there. So if you're looking at that data center, and that might be operating, say, with the server outputs at 120 degrees, or even, say, 140 degrees with a higher delta T, a higher temperature difference between the inlet and outlet air, well, if that starts to get squeezed down more and more, so instead of having 120, and normally you're feeding it with 100 degree Fahrenheit air, and the output from those servers is 120, that gives you a 20 degree delta T. Well, if that input air is 105, 110, suddenly that temperature difference isn't as high, and you have to move a lot more air to do the same amount of cooling. A lot of data centers just aren't prepared to do that. They don't have the fans to do that. They don't have the capability to do that. So what they're looking at is, how do they redesign? And what some might look at is going back and putting their data centers in more of a deep freeze. In other words, lowering their normal operating temperature, say during the night. So when they know that that surge is coming and their mechanical equipment that was designed for a certain max capacity, it starts to surge, well, that temperature difference starts to go up and up and up. And by putting that data center, say, way down at, you know, like 80, 70, or even 60 degrees Fahrenheit for some reason, that would help you with mitigating a lot of that temperature difference. Well, that might be the approach to that. And that used to be the old school approach. But that's when we had much lower densities, when we had single digits for our KW, or even we were just talking in watts per square foot. And that might be the case where a lot of data center managers are going to say, well, it's time to, you know, lower our data center temperatures again in order to prevent this against this heat wave, in order to plan against it, and just keep them there. Well, that's probably not going to be the best approach because the densities are much higher, and it won't matter if your temperature is down, say, at 70 or 80 degrees Fahrenheit on your normal data center floor. Because your density is so high, you're just going to end up heating up just so fast by the time you hit midday that if your mechanical equipment can't keep up with it at, say, 8 a.m., it's not going to keep up with it, you know, in a couple hours either. And that amount of extra cooling that you did, sort of like trying to store that cooling, you know, or have like some sort of thermal momentum on that cooling, that's non-existent in today's modern data centers. I wanted to touch on something that had come up a little while ago in one of the actual in-person events where someone at a colocation facility was looking at just what that power rankings were and how that we keep talking about the power keeps going up and up, but he's not quite seeing it yet from a lot of their customers that they have moving in. As a matter of fact, they have the standard of like, well, it's 5 kW a rack until they actually do something higher than that. Now, a lot of us might experience a lot different effects, but it seems to be very prevalent. That's what they're looking at. And that's one of the things that whenever they do compare numbers from one co-location to another, and they have somebody else moving in from, you know, they're trying out the cloud, and they're moving into this colocation facility to cut costs and overall maintenance, etc. But one of the things that you have to look at is the overall servers and what they're using. I mean, even before, it used to be that you look at these servers and what they were doing is, you know, as far as like the watts and such, it was, you know, you look at the amount of watts that they'd be having, and you could count on it being about 120, 140. But about 5 years ago, we started to really pick up the pace. And today's modern servers, you know, the number of cores, the typical power, the watts, it keeps going up. And you can see that the number of transistors, everything like that just keeps going up. And that means that the amount of power that we're really looking at is starting to creep up from that, you know, again, 120 watts, 140 watts to 180, 205 is the normal. And that starts to become more and more the average. And then you start looking at what the manufacturers can start putting out. And even though we might have these shortages on chips and such, that's starting to unfreeze, we're starting to see that that is higher. What, you know, these companies are putting out is a 400 watt CPU, or, you know, like the HPE ProLiant has a 280 watt CPU, and then add on top of that that suddenly we've got all sorts of memory that we're stacking in there with more and more, you know, just higher memory, and you can just stack that in there. You have all these other cards, these drives that are going to be much higher on the power, and suddenly you're starting to look at overall the total amount of power that you're looking at is starting to increase. Maybe those particular customers that are moving in from one data center that they once operated and owned into that colocation facility, maybe that's one aspect where they're just making a lateral move without upgrading any of their equipment. But more and more, you're starting to see that, hey, well, why not do both at the same time? Why move all of this equipment when we can just buy new, migrate everything with that colocation or whoever you're moving, you know, if you're moving to the cloud or however you're doing that, you can figure out how to do that faster and better. And typically, whenever they're doing that, they're making a really good efficiency move as well. And I mentioned all this power going up. Yeah, it's definitely an efficiency move there, as well as on the facility level. So those facilities, the colocation, the hyperscalers are going to operate that much better, usually typically way better than a lot of those enterprise data centers that have been operating. So that's even without talking about some of the, you know, the specialty equipment where we are seeing, hey, we can go ahead, you know, and take some things from Open Compute and just look at it to say, we've got 600, 700 watts. That's how they're building that in that Open Compute platform. And they're just showing everybody how they're going to be looking at it. Well, of course, they have their own cooling challenges that go with them. But what it gets at is suddenly we're looking at the capability that it might be more and more standard to have that at 2 to 3 to 400 watts and going up. Now, this isn't to say that it can't be done in a lot of ways to keep going and adding that capacity. One of the places that this has been done and things can be changed has been at the Massachusetts Green High Performance Computing Center, MGHPCC, and its location in Holyoke, Massachusetts. It's a little north of Springfield, not really near Boston, but the idea is that you can go ahead and have different solutions based on what these computing needs are. And just like a lot of data centers, they might, you know, they're evolving and you might have that evolution as well. So you might be doing some in-row cooling, or you bring that those coolers to be in-row with even water overhead like they do. And that makes a lot of people nervous when you bring those cooling units, say, instead of the crack units being along the side, or you have these air handlers that, you know, are along the side blowing into the rows, but you're actually bringing that cooling right into the rows with that compute. It really makes people nervous to do that. It probably shouldn't, but it still does, especially if you have it overhead because you don't have a raised floor anymore. And that's one of the things that maybe you've kind of gotten away from as soon as you sort of probably hit around 10 kW per rack. And check out their site, by the way, the mghpcc.org site. They've got a lot of information there that they just share freely, and it's a great read for some of these things, especially with different aspects of the data center itself. Something else that really caught my eye and ear lately was that of the hydrogen-powered data center, and that was by Microsoft, where they essentially took 3 megawatts of a generator test to go ahead and power their data center facility, or part of their facility. And it's not fully Microsoft. They worked with a group called Plug Power that was scaling the idea of the hydrogen power instead of having a typical diesel generator power. Now, the overall idea of hydrogen fuel cells is what we're talking about, having them back up a data center. I've waffled back and forth on hydrogen as a source. There was a book that was released a number of years ago called The Hype of Hydrogen, and it really outlines some of the issues with being able to generate the amount of hydrogen that we might need on the megawatt level. So bringing it up to speed with, say, gasoline, and originally it was aimed at the automotive industry, and that's where a lot of the development for hydrogen fuel cells transpired. But the intent was to apply it wherever there might need to be, like, any sort of diesel backup as well. So anything with a diesel engine or a regular gasoline engine, you could potentially look at having hydrogen fuel cells as the power alternate. Now, one of the things that looks nice about this is through the years, it's gotten better and better, the use of the hydrogen generators. And that's because they're using the proton exchange membrane, the PEM, PEM. And all we're doing is looking to combine hydrogen and oxygen. It creates chemical reaction, and that gets us electricity. It also, of course, because it's hydrogen and oxygen, generates water and heat. There's no combustion. There's nothing like an emissions, and therefore there's no carbon emissions that go along with that at that source. Now, of course, hydrogen, we are going to have to generate that somehow. So that's where we have to look at where that supply line is. And there is green hydrogen that's out there. But right now, that availability and economic viability is something that still needs to be ramped up as well. Now, fuel cells in general might have gotten a little bit of a bad name because sometimes they are really good on certain circumstances, like accepting a base load and having that base load be nice and even and predictable and not really ramping up and down. But these PEM fuel cells, the ones that we're talking about with the hydrogen generators here, are really good at being able to follow those loads as they increase or decrease very quickly. Plus, they can be turned on very quickly as well. So that's one of the things that we've gotten really used to in the industry is the generators, diesel generators, just firing on as soon as you lose load in order to take the whole facility off of any UPS or batteries type systems as soon as possible. Now, we usually talk about that in seconds as opposed to minutes like we used to. And the same happens with these hydrogen fuel cells. They can do the same thing. So that's great just to say, oh, let's open the valves, let's get this whole thing going. And of course, the whole thing just starts generating electricity that matches the load very fast in seconds. So we're going to get used to that probably as soon as we can start to scale up this type of technology in the way that I think Microsoft is looking to do. Now, the way that Microsoft did do this is they're looking at what the viability of it is, because they have their roadmap ahead to say that they want to be carbon neutral. Like, a lot of the big tech companies are leading the charge on that. This is one of the technologies that they're going to leverage. And if you follow them from a while back, they are reducing the amount of diesel they're even using in most of their data centers today. So it's biodiesel is what they've converted to. And they even want to get away from that by using the hydrogen fuel cells here. And the issue I think that they're running into is that scalability. How do you get to 3 megawatts? And then, you know, if that's your typical generator size, that's one thing. But how do you go ahead and start to replace that for all of your generators and then start to scale as you're trying to build data centers at the same time you're trying to replace? There's a lot of opportunity for these hydrogen fuel cells to really ramp up and replace all of these generators. However, you have to look at what they're made of, all the supplies, everything else, including the amount of hydrogen that you're going to be looking at, the availability of it. And once that starts to get more and more available, it's going to be much more of a viable solution. So we're probably going to see more of those come online to fully replace the generators. And we might even see a data center in the next year or two that has that as their solution from the start of the design of the project all the way through fruition. Or maybe they're turning over an entire data center in another year or so just to make sure that they can run everything on that hydrogen fuel. Now, these are stationary fuel cells that Plug Power is looking to deploy. They're going to make iterations and improvements along the way, including making them smaller. And whenever you think about generators and everything that has to go around the design and implementation of the generators, you're looking at things like fuel oil, and we can not have to worry about that if you're having a hydrogen fuel cell that can go ahead and operate. But of course, hydrogen is combustible, same with oxygen. So suddenly you're providing different matters that you're concerned about, and how do you mitigate any of those risks that you might foresee? We might see the rollout of these larger units, these stationary units, instead of just this 3 megawatt kind of chunk. And you oftentimes think of a generator being deployed at 2 megawatts, 3 megawatts, whatever that might be that data center operator wants to operate at. That fuel cell might be scalable to a certain degree across the board. So you might be able to say, well, we're only going to go in 1 megawatt components, and you just have a bus bar or the electrical system can go ahead and figure out how do we go ahead and scale that against what we need. And then we just connect in the fuel cells as we deploy more equipment. And that is the way to go. So we might see some of that where it becomes much more flexible than the typical generator, 2-3 megawatt chunks that you might see landed and costing, say, $1 million or more, depending on what type of generators, etc., in order to land those. You might see these fuel cells start to ramp down on the cost, and the flexibility goes up, as well as the footprint might even go down. Now, there's other things, like I had mentioned, that you might have to go ahead and figure out, like maybe there needs to be a certain separation, or you can only have so much hydrogen in a certain area. We'll get there, but in the meantime, there might be a great opportunity to go carbon-free across your data center with these hydrogen fuel cells and still do it way better than what we have with these diesel generators as far as size, capacity, and flexibility. It would be remiss of me not to touch on the big news that happened in July with Jim Chanos. And he's an investor. And if you haven't heard of him, what he's looking at, the short story is he's a short seller, and he's short selling data centers. And that means all of the big REITs, if you think of Digital Realty or some of those other big groups out there, that's who he's looking to sell short on and make money off of that. In essence, he's betting against the growth of the data center industry, which is... it made me smile and shake my head a bit, because I think, as a lot of insiders know, what? Like, why would you even think that? If you've been in the business of data centers, you realize that they are growing, and they are growing fast. And he even called out, like, look, the cloud is going to be the enemy of those big REITs. And that, again, makes me laugh and kind of shake my head that somebody doesn't read the fine print or doesn't know enough about the data center business to really understand that it keeps growing in the way it does because of the cloud, and it's coupled with everything that's going on and big data and everybody else that's looking for space, looking to have all these deployments of data center space and equipment. Now, I have to state that I'm not a financial advisor, you know, and those of us in the data center industry advising that industry, you can see that even when there is like a slump, it's more just about a slowing of growth, not even a plateau, but just, hey, we seem to be evening out on capacity versus what's needed out there and those demand triggers. And you can talk to the economists and look at what they're looking at and really see that the amount of data and everything just keeps surging forward year after year. Now, looking at what Chandos has said about some of the things, it becomes apparent that he really looks at all those big hyperscalers as being vicious competitors against all those REITs, these REITs. And whenever you look at it, most of the time they're not even competing. They are just looking to problem solve to make sure that they have the capacity and bring that online. And we're not talking online in a couple months. Usually it's online 6 months, a year, 2 years, 5 years. That's the kind of growth plans that each of these companies is looking at. And when they are revealing that and sort of tipping their hand a little bit to one another to realize what they need to have and where that needs to go, they start to work with each other to realize, well, we've got some real estate over here. We've got some things we could develop over there. And that's where it becomes a team effort with a lot of these groups figuring out how to deliver capacity. And on top of that, one of the big constraints is that power and making sure that you can get the power where you need to, as well as the fiber, all these other things that work together to sort of hamper you. Well, if you have a developer like a REIT that can come in and help fix and solve these things, that's what these hyperscalers are really about. They are looking to bring out more and more capacity online so that they're not constrained on their business side. And they can go ahead and say, well, we have somebody that's a partner with us solving these things for us because they know the real estate industry a little bit better, or they've been had a practiced hand at doing this for a while. And that's where that has been going. And I don't see that stopping in the near future. Another point that Chandos tries to make is that all of these REITs are chasing all these hyperscalers as if they're the only customer that's out there. The hyperscalers tend to be the ones that push for the hardest and the fastest, and they usually, it looks like, pay their bills on time and pay well. But there's all of these other enterprises, and it's not even, you know, 5% of the enterprises have gone to a co-location. There is a lot of opportunity for all these co-location and REITs to go ahead and reach out and land a lot of their equipment in these other data centers with people that can operate them much better, more efficiently, and more nimbly than somebody might have their own enterprise data center that they're operating on their own and have a little bit of a difficult time keeping up with the rest of the industry. One of the points that they made, though, is supply chain issues, and that is that's one of the things that the entire industry has been dealing with. And when you have that supply chain pressure and you're trying to build out the next room or build out the next data center, and you're an Equinix or Digital Realty looking at this, that's where you've got that pressure coupled with everything else that you're looking at. And then you realize that certain customers, you might already have the rates built in. But as we've noticed, like there's a big change in those interest rates that you might be looking at for what you originally promised on a deal and what has been changing and how that reflects in the modern environment. So year over year, you just have to reset and take a look at that. But then you throw in that supply chain and how you can go ahead and grab customers and bring them to the market, bring them into your co-location facility. It might take a little bit longer to do than it did before. So that's something that they have to deal with, but they're not the only ones though. So if you think about all these hyperscalers and all of these major companies, they're the ones that can buy at scale as well. So they can really look to force their supply chains to deliver faster and really push to, say, you know, be the best customer for buying the next 2 or 3 megawatt generators that come down the line, and therefore get kind of pushed up into the line or into the queue. Meanwhile, like a lot of those enterprises, they're buying secondhand equipment because they can't get it from the manufacturers in a timely fashion, or they just can't get it the way that they want it. And some of that just has to do with how they're operating their facility. Meanwhile, a co-location might be operating it much more efficiently and much more smoothly and evenly. And it does make sense for those enterprises to start to look more and more towards those co-location facilities as being the better option for their overall capacity delivery. And to summarize, I just don't think that this short sell call by Chanos is a good idea. This wouldn't be his first miss. He did the same on Tesla a few years back and was a major miss. And of course, he's a betting man, right, on the stock market by reading those analyses. But I would say that I think the data center industry is just fine. And I would probably push back to say he didn't do enough research and he didn't read enough to understand what the industry is all about. I think a lot of that information is already out there and we can start to see a lot of those predictions. And it's just easy enough to disprove most of the points that they bring up in any type of those reports, whether it's in the Financial Times or it's somebody barking on a TV show about how to short sell data centers. Thank you for listening to Season 4, Episode 1 of the Green Data Center Podcast. Be sure to like and subscribe what you thought was good today. And of course, we want your feedback. If you thought things were amiss, awry, or if there's corrections that need to be issued, love to hear about it. To give that feedback, you can visit us at the greendatacenterman.com website. And there you can go to the contacts page, fill out the form, and we'll be happy to read and get back to you for the next episode, if not directly. Also on the website are links to the Data Center Essentials courses. It's a nice entry level into the data center industry. And if you just want to get a good summary of the electrical or mechanical or just the general industry knowledge, that's a good place to start. The links on the website go straight to udemy.com with the discounts included. But if you want to get it directly, feel free to contact us. We can send it to you directly.